Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a tough job, but somebody's got to figure out the latest unemployment numbers, because on the face of it, they don't seem to make any sense. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing partner to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/grow.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. We made it to Friday. It's the fourth day of February, and we're glad to have you with us. This new monthly jobs report came out this morning, and it left a lot of economists puzzled. Employers added only 36,000 jobs in January, and yet the unemployment rate fell from 9.4 down to 9%. To try to explain that drop, we've called on Heidi Shierholz. She's a labor market economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Heidi, thanks for guiding us through this.
Thanks for having me.
Isn't this a strange report? You've got one survey showing so few jobs being added, yet on the other hand, the unemployment rate falls so much. How can that be?
It's actually a very good question. This is indeed a confusing report. We are actually going to have to wait for next month's data to really get a handle on what happened in January.
So help me understand what seems to be the impossible here. What's the cause of this confusion?
The underlying cause of this confusion is that the government actually collects two different surveys. One survey, they go out and ask businesses, how many people do you have on payroll? And another survey, they go out and ask people, are you employed right now? And usually those surveys sort of move in tandem because they're both getting at two sides of the exact same coin. How many jobs are there in the economy? Every once in a while, you hit a month where those two surveys, it's difficult to reconcile them. January was one of those months. When you ask businesses, how many people do you have on payroll, there wasn't very much growth in the business survey. But when you ask people, do you have a job, there was a lot of employment growth in that household survey. The rule of thumb, when you do have a difference like that, is you go with what the establishment survey says. And the reason that is the establishment survey is a survey of 400,000 businesses every month, as opposed to the survey of households, which is a survey of 55,000 households. One thing that was really sort of quirky about the January data is that there were big snowstorms in the Midwest and the Northeast in the very week that businesses are asked, how many people do you have on payroll?
Okay, now I'm still scratching my head here, though. We're seeing this huge pool of missing workers. One economist joked that maybe they were abducted by aliens or something. Mm-hmm. But in all seriousness, where did the rest of the unemployed go?
The improvement in unemployment that we saw in the household survey actually had nothing to do with increasing the pool of missing workers. In that survey, it really did show that unemployment declined because people got jobs.
Okay, now I know that these figures are always revised, but is January an especially difficult month for calculating unemployment?
Yeah, there's a lot of revision thrown into the mix in January. So you get these big population revisions in the household survey. In the establishment survey, they do this big benchmark revision that shows a much larger comprehensive practical census of businesses that happen in March of every year. And so one of the things that we learned when the data came out is that the economy actually had around 500,000 fewer jobs last December than we thought it did. Now, that didn't impact the month-over-month changes, but it does show, with this new data comes out, that the Great Recession actually took about 500,000 more jobs than we previously thought it had.
What I'm hearing from you and other economists is a great big to be continued, huh?
That's right. It remains to be seen what the real underlying story is to this. Next month, I'm hoping and praying that we won't have big snowstorms during the reference week so we can get a really clear read for February and get a much clearer idea of just how fast the labor market is improving at this point.
Heidi Shierholz is a labor market economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Heidi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We put together a cool graphic that illustrates the U.S. labor market by those who are employed, unemployed, or not looking. That's at marketplace.org. We know now, of course, that Bernard Madoff caused billions in investor losses. But newly unsealed lawsuits are shedding new lights on those who allegedly profited from the Ponzi scheme. Today, the focus was on the owners of the New York Mets. A day earlier, court documents alleged the country's biggest bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, long suspected fraud, but kept doing business with Madoff and profited. Should the bank have shared its concerns with regulators? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
J.P. Morgan emerged from the financial crisis bigger, stronger, and with its reputation intact. Now, a lawsuit by the trustee in the Bernard Madoff case could give the bank a black eye. J.P. Morgan was Madoff's main bank. Some people there suspected as far back as 2006 that Madoff's returns were too good to be true. But the bank didn't inform regulators until 2 months before Madoff surrendered himself. Reuben Gutman heads the whistleblower practice at law firm Grant & Eisenhoffer.
Clearly, they should have stepped forward earlier and they should have done something about it earlier.
J.P. Morgan says it didn't know what Madoff was up to. But if the bank had anything bigger than a hunch, it should have pulled a fire alarm. So says Katrina Campbell, who trains financial employees in ethics for a firm called Global Compliance.
The legal aspect of it is not only whether you had actual knowledge, it's also whether you had a reckless disregard for the truth. In other words, the truth was staring you in the face, but you chose to ignore it.
Some believe that J.P. Morgan, with its strength and its reputation, could have tipped the scales enough to push the SEC to investigate Madoff. Instead, the lawsuit claims, J.P. Morgan quietly moved out $276 million of its own money from Madoff's funds.
The time has come that we now have to start saying, you know what, it's not only about the money. We are in the business of making money and handling money, but that requires that we pay attention to problems and we raise them.
There is a potentially expensive price for keeping quiet. The suit seeks to recover $6.4 billion. I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Wall Street reached some new highs for the year today. As unconvincing as they were, those unemployment figures may have had something to do with that. Details when we do the numbers. It's Friday, thank goodness, and so time to look back on the week that was in business and finance. Mostly we focus on our domestic economy, but it was hard to escape the events in Egypt this week. To do the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond, John Carney from CNBC and Felix Salmon from Reuters. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
One of the underlying factors of the protest in Egypt and elsewhere is youth unemployment. It's kind of a global problem, isn't it? One could argue even here in the U.S. Felix?
Well, unemployment of all sorts is a problem here in the U.S. If you look at the Middle East, then it's especially true of youth. But you have to remember that these are some of the youngest countries in the world. Demographically speaking, most of the population is young, so it kind of makes sense that most of the unemployment is concentrated in that age group too. The problem is that even once they get educated, there are no jobs for them. And what you need is serious structural reforms, which are not coming from the current leadership. And that's why the current leadership is being pushed out.
Not an easy fix, right, John?
Absolutely. A lot of these countries, Tunisia and Egypt, spent a lot of money educating their population. They actually have pretty good education systems. The problem is it's a dead end. There's nowhere for people to go because, as Felix said, the economy is structurally unsound and can't create opportunities for these people once they have their college educations.
So the events of this week were unsettling to the oil markets in particular, but not so much the stock or bond markets. Why not, Felix?
Egypt's a small country as far as the international capital markets are concerned. It's not important in terms of money. It's very important politically. And so ultimately, if the sort of political repercussions of what's going on echo through, they could have an important effect on global geopolitics and global markets. But right now, no one's entirely sure whether that effect is going to be positive or negative. And so the markets aren't really moving, partly because the people who are scared that things are going to get much worse are counterbalanced by the people who are optimistic that things are actually going to get significantly better.
John, Wall Street keeps right on whistling.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of fear about what would happen if Egypt blew up, even if it carries on into countries like Syria or Jordan. None of these countries are really that central to global financial markets in any way that – so you get a couple stocks that go down because they have a lot of exposure to this country or that country. But generally, it's not a big fear for investors or for people on Wall Street.
Well, let's take Tunisia and Yemen and Jordan and now the Sudan. This unrest has really got the potential to spread, it seems. How might this affect the very fragile economic recovery?
In the U.S., I don't think it's going to have any effect on the U.S. economy at all, frankly, in terms of like the big picture, GDP growth, that kind of thing. The U.S. economy is relatively self-contained, and we don't do much trading or business with the Middle East. And so, as I say, the big effects are going to be political. They're not going to be economic.
John, are we really that insulated?
Well, we're insulated as long as the Suez Canal doesn't get shut down, as long as Saudi Arabia isn't disrupted, which nobody really thinks that this will spread to Saudi Arabia, in part because they take in so much money from all the oil that they sell to the rest of the world. They're able to spread enough of that wealth around. And so their people aren't as desperate as the people in, say, Tunisia or in Egypt are.
Yeah, but one American who is not insulated from all of this is Barack Obama. Is this going to distract him at all?
It could distract him. I think he's actually done a pretty good job of not trying to look as if the U.S. is trying to determine the outcome of what's happening in Egypt. It's very important for the rest of the world and for the people of Egypt that it look both the reality and the image that Egypt is deciding its destiny, not the U.S.
But should we be at all concerned that this takes the focus off job one, the economy and the recovery?
I don't think so. When the House passes a bill which could actually help the economy, I'm sure Barack Obama is going to find the time to pass it. In the meantime, we have gridlock in the Congress, and so there's precious little that the president can actually do right now.
Exactly.
John Carney from CNBC and Felix Salmon from Reuters, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you.
As we reported earlier, it was a head-scratcher of a month when it comes to job creation, but we do know this much. We're still seeing people leave the job hunt altogether and go out on their own. They're setting up as solo consultants, putting up websites to sell online, or launching full-blown startups. From the Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman introduces us to a family of these new rebound entrepreneurs. In this case, they're looking back a few hundred years in history to get their new business off the ground.
Bonjour, my name is Henri-François Letonnier. The year we are in here is 1745, and I am dressed as a Corot du Bois, an unlicensed trader for furs here in the
Pardonnez, s'il vous plaît, the fake French, but in real life...
I'm Jean Tesdall. I help do the historical editing for Journal of the Early Americas, a new publication that is launching here right now in 2011.
The Journal is a magazine for historical reenactors, people who dress up in woolen breech clouts, carry flintlock muskets, cook in brass kettles, and replay the French and Indian War or life on the Oregon Trail. Tesdall, his wife, her father, and sister are mailing their first magazine issue this week. I met up with them at a launch party at Journal headquarters. It's the Denver area home of Tesdall's father-in-law, Casey Criswell. He also likes to don the colonial garb.
And I would be a merchant. Very comfortable and very prosperous.
That laughter from the rest of the family might just be because life hasn't been prosperous of late. Criswell was a successful construction consultant. Then the commercial real estate market collapsed.
My personal income has completely disappeared.
Fortunately, his wife still has her job at a big biotech company. Daughter Summer, age 24, got her graphic design degree in 2009 and was promptly unemployed for 6 months. Finally, she landed a job in online sales, then got laid off. She's got an interesting take on her own misfortune.
If it weren't for the recession, we wouldn't have been able to start this magazine because none of us would have been around. You know, we wouldn't have had the time, and it worked out really well to just lend my skills to it.
So far, Summer's lending those skills without compensation. The magazine has a handful of advertisers, people who make birch bark canoes and trade trinkets for wannabe frontier trappers. More than 100 subscribers have signed up for the first 6 issues at $30 a year. It'll take 1,000 to break even.
And when Casey first said this idea to me, I thought this wasn't a good idea.
That's Gene, the faux French son-in-law, and his skepticism carried some weight because he's already in the not-too-well-paid history business, getting his PhD and teaching part-time.
Right now you hear a lot about how this is not the time to launch businesses of most kinds, as well as print media.
But there's so much expense to running a magazine, it's hard to make money.
Startup advisor Riva Lazansky should know. She used to edit the magazine Entrepreneur. I asked, would she launch a print publication now?
Wow, I would not. I mean, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade. I think that the success that you can find in magazines today is in the niches, in those really specialized fields.
Like historical reenactment enthusiasts, 1521 to 1848. The publishers of Journal of the Early Americas think they'll succeed because they know this niche, people who want to read footnoted articles about things like authentic tobacco pouches and how early settlers navigated the Des Moines Rapids.
So we're going to make some syllabub. It's an alcoholic milkshake, very popular in the American colonies in both.
Gene Tesdall is making colonial punch from a how-to
British
article
North
in
America,
the first issue.
Putting into that Muscovado sugar, and then I'm going to add Madeira wine.
Okay, that's not some Madeira. That's actually quite a lot of Madeira.
Well, historical accuracy is one of their selling points. But so is being up to date with a website, Facebook page, and Twitter feed. All part of marketing in the modern era, says Casey Criswell. Remember, he plays the prosperous merchant.
I've had employees and I've run a business, and the whole point is to make money.
Maybe not right away, but eventually, enough to employ at least one unemployed daughter and provide income for that prosperous merchant's comfortable retirement as well. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Good au revoir. Oui, oui, oui. Good au revoir. No, no, no. Good au revoir. Si le vin est bon. Good au revoir. Oui, oui, oui. Good au revoir. No, no, no. Good au revoir. Si le vin est bon.
Coming up,
I could not have been the first person to develop this concept. It's like the Post-it. It's so simple.
Forget the pink jerseys. Women have a new way, lots of them actually, to support their favorite teams. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 29 points, or 0.25%, to end at 12,092. The NASDAQ advanced 15 points, or 0.5%, to finish at 2769, its best week in 9. The S&P 500 built up 3 points, nearly 0.3%, to close at 1310. For the week, the Dow added 2.3%, the S&P 500 climbed 2.7%, the NASDAQ powered up 3.1% since Monday. Glimmers of economic improvement and some strong corporate earnings kept the markets going as investors shifted from some sectors, like energy, into others, like technology. Oil services giant Halliburton lost 1.8%, while Amazon clicked in with a 1.25% rise. Aetna added more than 12%. The health insurer said 2011 earnings would beat expectations. Aon, the world's biggest insurance broker, marched up 4.33%. Fourth quarter earnings there topped expectations. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions that can help to guarantee income for life. Allianzusa.com. By Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the Knowledge Effect. and by Reputation.com, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for the month of December. Ever wonder what it's like to be the White House press secretary? Five people who have held that job discuss their experience. The event takes place at the George Washington University. And on February 7, 1943, during World War II, shoe rationing went into effect. Consumers were limited to buying three pairs per year. Yikes! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Okay, admittedly, this is not news. Verizon's iPhone has sold at record speed. Duh. But if you're keeping track, the company says it ran out of pre-orders in less than a day. The real news turns out to be a surprise that could curb the enthusiasm of some buyers. Seems Verizon has slipped in a change to its data policy. Download too much and you might get throttled. That's not so much a personal threat as it is a technical term. Here's Marketplace's Adrienne Hill.
Being throttled basically means your wireless carrier slows down the speed that you can download data. And Verizon's new policy gives the company the right to do just that, at least for the really hardcore data junkies out there. But, says company spokesman Jeffrey Nelson, Verizon's not doing it now. And even with all the iPhone traffic coming online,
we do not expect anytime soon to need to implement the network management policies that we have introduced.
Nelson says the other major carriers already have this sort of provision, and Verizon has to have a policy in place to make sure that all customers get good service. As for knowing what sort of downloading might trigger a throttle, maybe a whole lot of video or gaming or something else?
They are such important questions, but they are unknown at this point.
And that's a problem, says Glenn Fleischman. He's a freelance journalist and blogger who covers the wireless industry.
Verizon isn't in the wrong to set a limit. They're making it harder on their customers by not providing clear guidance on what that means.
Think of an unlimited data plan like an all-you-can-eat Chinese restaurant. There is, at some level, a limited amount of bandwidth for mobile phones, like there's a limited amount of food at the restaurant.
Going back 20 times to the all-you-can-eat buffet, any reasonable person would say that's unreasonable.
But what counts as an unreasonable data appetite, Fleischman says, is not a decision we can trust phone carriers to make in favor of customers. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
You might have heard about this, something of a big event coming up this weekend involving the Green Bay Packers and the Pittsburgh Steelers, and it's generating some excitement judging by the $10 billion expected to be spent on the game this year when you add up all the chips and beer, new TVs, and of course team-themed gear, including a lot more designed specifically for the female fan. Enter Millie Jefferson, our colleague and resident sports nut. She'll be rooting for the Packers this weekend, so to wish her and her team well, we got her a little something. Okay, this is for you.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, tell us what you got there.
I have a pair of Green Bay gloves with palms on the end of them.
Now, what are you going to do with these?
Well, surely I'm wearing them on Sunday.
The gloves are called Spirit Fingers, with a Z on the end of the name, kind of like the pom-poms on the end of the fingertips.
the name came as quickly as the concept did.
Which is to say, in minutes, Teresa Denham came up with the idea, getting ready for a cold night at a Virginia Tech game a few years back.
As a child, I had taken the pom-poms and put them in my hair, in my shoes, and on my way out to this Virginia Tech game, all of a sudden they appeared on this pair of gloves.
Teresa took her creation to market in 2008. Dozens of collegiate and NFL teams later, she's got a million-dollar business.
I oftentimes think I could not have been the first person to develop this concept. It's like the Post-it. It's so simple.
Never occurred to me. But as they say, timing is everything. Consumer research group NPD reports the women's segment of sportswear and sporting goods is booming. It grew 16% last year. John Long is a retail strategist with Kurt Salmon in New York.
Men aren't the only couch potatoes around. There's about 45 million women who watch professional football each weekend. And so a lot of this merchandise is catering to that ever-growing and quite large population.
The NFL's caught on. John Long points out the website women.nfl.com. It features the wives of players, owners, and coaches talking about fashion and peddling team T-shirts and sweatshirts tailored to a woman's silhouette.
It's not just about having the T-shirt that's pink, right? It's about having a T-shirt that feels good, looks good.
One of the web shop's taglines, "This ain't your daddy's NFL gear." Terry Lefton is editor-at-large for the Sports Business Journal. He says it's no wonder the women's market for sports products is growing. There's not a whole lot more you can push to men.
We're almost at the point where you can name a product and it's probably got a license on it. You can buy a trailer hitch with a license on it. You could buy a barbecue with a license on it. Or actually, one of my favorite things for the Packers is that there's still time for your Super Bowl party to go out and buy a Packers logo cheese board if you really want to.
With 110 million people expected to tune into the game this time, perhaps the largest audience ever, Lefton says the winning team might just sell a record amount of product, too. So if that other team wins, sorry, Millie, you can also find Spirit Fingers in black and gold, or a pair of black and gold striped tights, or nail polish, or, well, you get the idea.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note, there's a gleaming office building in Washington, D.C. that was sold at a big loss a year ago. The property owner owed more than it was worth, and let's just say it was an outfit that you might never guess would get itself into such a predicament. The building was unloaded for around $41 million, and now we hear the buyer has just succeeded in flipping it for more than double the price, $101 million. The original owner that got caught underwater and missed out on all those profits? None other than the Mortgage Bankers Association. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media today. The Dow gained 29 points, or 0.25%. The Nasdaq advanced 15 points, or 0.5%. The S&P 500 built up 3 points, nearly 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, marriage is all about being open and honest, right? Well, for some, every rule has an exception.
Maybe it's a little bit lying because you're hiding it from him. Because I do know that when I purchase a new bag, I do kind of feel guilty and I won't bring it out for a little while.
It's a sort of real-life soap opera on financial infidelity. I'm Bob Moon. We're hoping you can join Kai back here on Monday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.